Colin Blunstone, Rod Argent, Chris White, Paul Atkinson, and Hugh Grundy first entered Abbey Road, then called EMI Recording Studios, in June of 1967. Armed with only £1,000 for a recording budget and the ambition to self-produce their second album, the band famously walked into Studio 2 on the heels of the Beatles, who had just finished recording Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The Beatles had cleared out, but some of their detritus remained, such as John Lennon's Mellotron, which can be heard quite a bit through that album, Odyssey and Oracle. More than 50 years later, the legendary Rock and Roll Hall of Famers are returning to Abbey Road Studios in London to perform The Zombies, live from Studio 2, their first and only world tour in one night performance and live stream on September 18th, 2021. The concert will begin at 12 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and 8 p.m. British Standard Time. As Rod would say,
"Please come on time."
However, ticket buyers will be able to stream the concert until October 2nd.
The event coincides with the start of Abbey Road's 90th anniversary celebrations
and will be followed by a Q&A hosted by
rock journalist David Frick. The live stream is presented by Veeps, a direct-to-fan experiential platform that's custom-built for artists by artists. Veeps was founded in 2017 by musicians Benji and Joel Madden, and it's unique
because it ensures profits go to the musical artists.
Tickets can be purchased at thezombies.veeps.com/. There are also special ticket packages with exclusive merchandise and lots of goodies.
And remember, it's always best when you...
Hey, this is Becky, and I got the chance to sit down with Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone and talk about their upcoming show at Abbey Road. Here's Rod.
This is Rod Argent from The Zombies, and it's really great to be going back to Abbey Road. They, in fact, initiated the idea. They asked us to do it, and we jumped at the chance because it has been a special place for us. We've recorded some of the stuff that we've most liked there, including Odyssey and Oracle, her first self-produced album. And for me personally, later on, I recorded Hold Your Head Up at Abbey Road, which was a huge hit as well around the world. We can't wait to go back to that special place.
The performance at Abbey Road, you know, kind of reminds me of when the Beatles did their live All You Need Is Love performance there.
Yeah, sure.
It's a global telecast. I didn't realize it was called EMI Studios at the time, so it is the same studio.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly,
yeah.
The same. It's Studio 2. And there are three studios in that building. We'll be in exactly the same room as the Beatles recorded All We Need Is Love for that TV special.
And even the type of song, All You Need Is Love, is this idealistic, utopian sort of song. And you know, for the Summer of Love and Time of the Season is a similar type of song. So do you see a, you know, kind of a parallel there
yeah,
as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. It has similarities in the sense that there was a sort of zeitgeist going on. And, you know, we weren't naive about, you know, love and peace and everything. We really weren't. But at the same time, something special in a way was happening because, and I always believe it was because for the first time, young people were getting a true idea of what war was all about, because they were actually seeing some of the early news footage, which was actually showing what was going on the ground in a war without being just jingoistic, you know, and without saying, hey, we had a great victory, you know, and we hardly had any casualties, etc. They were seeing the napalm, they were seeing some of this stuff going on. I mean, it's more graphic now, but even then they were seeing some of those things. And for the first time, they were saying, look, we don't want any part of this. You know, we want to change. And it was a powerful movement with all its drawbacks. It was powerful. And you couldn't help but be moved to some extent by what was going on. And as I said, we weren't naive about it. I mean, we knew the drawbacks to some of the things that were going on. But at the same time, I think when I wrote Time of the Season, it had that feeling was impinging itself, you know, on the background of the song, I think. Yeah, definitely.
Also, I mean, I know you wrote the song earlier before the record came out, but when it came out in 1969, a lot more had happened. You'd had the 1968 protest movement across Europe, so it was even more perfect, I think.
It did seem to hit a spot to some degree. And I'm really pleased. And you don't quite know what has influences. And some of these things just happen without being a very conscious thing. And I think with Time of the Season, that was part of what was happening as well.
You know, I can remember countless times when we've been talked to by head of A&R departments and managers, and they'll sort of get the number one record, especially in the 60s, this was true. They get the number one record and put it on a little record player, and they would say, you know, this is what you need to be writing and recording, this number one at the moment. But that's rubbish, because by the time you've written, recorded, promoted, marketed, that's old. And it happens that Time of the Season hit the spot in, was it 1969? We recorded it in 1967. It wasn't, we've never tried to be fashionable. We always tried to, if I can speak on Rod's behalf, write and record music that moved us.
And therefore hoped that it would move other people. We weren't particularly trying to have a number one hit record. And this is a prime example. It was recorded a couple of years before it came out, and people felt that it was really current, but it was more than that. It was already 2 years old, you know. And I think especially all the great writers and great performers, they've never followed trends. They try to write what they want and perform what they want and hope they can make a connection with the audience.
And you know, in some ways that was a drawback at first, because we would write something, as Colin said, which touched us. I mean, that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to get something that excited us, with the feeling that if we could feel a little bit that something was really working, then we stood a chance of communicating that to other people. And I think in the short term, that didn't help us, because sometimes we were writing stuff that wasn't very much like some of the other stuff that was around. And even with She's Not There, you know, the first hit that we had. But in the long term, I think it's really helped us. And it just astonishes both Colin and me now how we get really young people at gigs coming up and saying how much the stuff that we're doing now still, but the stuff we were doing then as well relates to them, and that was unlooked for. Yeah, I mean, we would never have dreamed that two or three generations on, you know, young people that were 18 or 19 years old were saying, oh, you know, I absolutely love that song when they hear it for the first time. Something that we wrote in 1964 with She's Not There, 1967 with Time of the Season, can actually still get across to people. And I think it's because we were never, as Colin said, trying to be fashionable. We were always trying to get excited about what we were doing. And that still is true now. And we're writing a new album at the moment. We just have exactly the same criteria. You know, we get out there, I usually finish a song and play it to Colin and see if it's something that he feels that he can relate to and that he can sing. And if we feel we're on the right path, then we complete it together and have a good time doing that. And then we'll take it to the band. And then if the band starts playing it and it starts to work, it's so exciting. That's still the most exciting thing in the world, you know, to have something new that is sparking and is actually being successful musically, I mean, you know, not necessarily commercially, but if it is successful commercially, then that's fantastic too. The last album still got that hunger. Actually, was in the top 100, Billboard's top 100 album sales for 3 weeks. They phoned us up to tell us that, and it was so sweet, you know, to hear that. So that, you know, that is exactly what our point of reference always is.
You guys had such a dramatic story in the 60s. You know, you got your start by winning the contest. You had this massive hit in America. And, you know, just right out of the gate, you had a very distinct sound, obviously, from the British Invasion groups. And there was a whole saga with Odyssey and Oracle and getting that out and having things beyond your control happen. You broke up. Then your song became this massive hit. And then a couple of fake zombies toured around America.
It's a very unusual story that we were only professional for 3 years, from 64 to 67. And it appeared to us that there wasn't really any interest in us. That's why the band finished in 1967. And then when Rod and I got back together again in 1999, we were amazed to feel the response of the audience, the interest there was in the Zombies repertoire. When we first got back together again, we hardly played any Zombie tunes. We didn't use the Zombies name. For 6 or 7 years, we played without using the Zombies name. But eventually, we were playing a Zombies concert. So we thought, well, we're not being dishonest if we say it's a zombie, you know, this is the Zombies. But it took a long time for us to realize the interest around the world in the Zombies repertoire. It was a surprise, but it was a very pleasant surprise. And I think it is a very unusual story. Most bands that have been playing for 50 or 60 years have played continuously through that time. Whereas we had this huge break where we thought there was no interest in us, and then we came back together again and we've built things up right from scratch. Believe me, when we first got back together again, we were playing in little rooms at the back of pubs, and we just gradually built it up. We played most of the major festivals, and we played most of the major halls in the world as well. Well, certainly in the UK and the States. I think that there is a timelessness about the songs that were written by Rod and Chris White, that they can still be used in films today, and they feel as fresh and as relevant today as when they were first recorded.
I agree with you. I was going to ask you about some of the movies and film. I really liked how The Way I Feel Inside was used in the movie The Life Aquatic.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful, and the emotion of the scene. Sure. So I want to ask, what are your favorite movie scenes where zombie songs were used?
Zombie tunes are in 3 movies this summer. Gosh. Cruella, the Disney film.
Right at the moment, yeah. Uh-huh.
The film that won the Cannes Film Festival is called Titane. Is that right, Rob? Titane?
Yeah.
And She's Not There is in that. And there's a new Cate Blanchard film, and it's called something about Bernadette. Ah, Where Do You Go, Bernadette? And one of our songs is in that as well. I think that's She's Not There as well. It is She's Not There. So we've got three songs in films this summer, as well as a big commercial in the States as well. It's a strange story. And I think that there is a timelessness about the songs that were written by Rod and Chris White. There is a timelessness about those songs that they can still be used in films today. And they feel as fresh and as relevant today as when they were first recorded.
It's difficult to know. I loved the one in Awakenings.
That was good.
That was really good. A lovely use of time and the season. And I think Randy Newman was the the curator of music on that on that particular movie. Have you got any favourites, Colin? I mean, there have been so many.
They have. It gets difficult to actually pick out one, doesn't it?
There are some things on series also. There's a Chris White song, which was on Odyssey and Oracle. This Will Be Our Year. And that's really garnered a life of its own now. It's really sort of risen. And one of my favourite series was a US series called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And at the very end of the whole of the last, what do you call it? You know, the third series or whatever it was. They played the whole of This Will Be Our Year. And it was really moving the way it came at that particular point. And I absolutely loved that. I mean, I thought it was terrific. And the thing is that because it was the last one in the series, you didn't get this thing that you often get on streaming, where they stop the whole thing after about 20 seconds and tell you when the next episode is going to be or what you should listen to next, you know, to do with this. They played just the whole thing. And that was one of my favorite moments because I didn't know it was coming. It was the end of the whole series and it's one of my favorite series. And suddenly there it was. And I thought, well, this is going on and on. When's it going to finish? You know, and they played the whole song. I thought that was really lovely.
You were watching it at the time?
And it just Sorry?
Were you watching it at the time and it just came on?
Yeah, I was watching it, yeah. And it just came on. And it, when it's a surprise like that, you know, it really hits you. So there you go.
They also played This Will Be Our Year on Mad Men.
Yes.
A really emotional scene. It made me cry. It was so sweet.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a simple song and it's so effective. It's it's a great song because I think the thing is that all great songs sound simple in the end. You know, they may not be simple, but they sound simple and direct. And that's certainly got it, that song, I think. And it's one of Chris's best, I think.
Yeah, and actually when we had the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony, they asked us to play a fourth song, and that's the song they asked us to play, This Will Be Our Year. So that was really exciting to play that in front of 17,000 people at the Barclay Centre in Brooklyn in 2019. It was great to play that wonderful song.
I can see why they'd have you play it. It's a great song, and it's really appropriate for the occasion. This will be our
Yeah.
So, Colin, you wrote one of my favorite zombie songs, Just Out of Reach. And what's amazing to me is it sounds just like a zombie song. How did you manage to do that?
Well, it's funny enough, I was thinking about this the other day. What happened, we were introduced to Otto Preminger, the film director, and we did a sort of an audition for him and his entourage in the basement of a club called the Cromwellian Club. So there was just him and his entourage watching us, and we passed the audition to do the songs for the film. But
we played Summertime, didn't we, Cole?
I think we did.
And he loved Gershwin. He knew Gershwin. And he was really impressed with it, yeah.
And he wanted three new songs written and recorded in about 10 days. Now, the reason he wanted new, I don't know whether it was him or the producers of the film or I don't know who, but they wanted new songs because they wanted a part of the publishing. And all our old songs were already signed to publishers. So there's no romance in this, you know. We were asked to write and record three songs in about 10 days. At the time, Rod didn't have a backlog of songs. He didn't have any songs available. Chris White had two songs, so we were one short. And so I took it upon myself to go home and rack my brains for an idea. And that's what I came up with.
And we still play it sometimes, don't we, on stage?
Yes, we do, as an encore number, yeah. It is it's a sort of a really good 60s little rock tune, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, the, taking into account the way it came about, it was written to order, really. They wanted a third song, and that's what it was. It has had a life of its own. And, it's great. We still play it. People love it.
Yeah, it's a great song. He didn't want to pay the licensing fees on Summertime, I'm guessing.
No, absolutely.
Let me ask you a question about touring. So, I mean, it seems like if you guys had a proper tour, you probably would have made a second LP before Odyssey and Oracle, because you have so many singles with great songs. But I wanted to ask you about the Dick Clark, was it Caravan of Stars that you went on? I was wondering if you had any stories about that tour or wanted to talk about your experiences in the deep South at that time, if you ran across any weirdness, because I would imagine you had a lot of soul music stars on that tour.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in the first place, a lot of the artists on the tour were paid so little that they couldn't afford a hotel every night. So that meant that the whole tour drove through the night on alternate nights. We'd only have a hotel every second night. And of course, especially when we got down in the South, there were a lot of soul acts on the bus, and there were places where we couldn't stay and places where we couldn't eat. You know, we couldn't stop at certain restaurants. And there were one or two very difficult moments. And of course, we'd never experienced anything like that before. We'd hardly ever been to America, let alone the Deep South. So it was quite challenging. But at the same time, it was a wonderful experience as well. And you know, to travel with those great artists. I mean, Rod often talks about, I think it was the second night we were on the bus, and they started up singing these wonderful spirituals through the night, you know. But it was an incredible experience for us. We'd never heard anything like it before. So overall, it was a magical experience, but there were certainly a few challenges.
We were. I remember when we first joined the bus on the Dick Clark tour, and you know, some of the artists were absolutely great. Some great black voices, which were just knocking us out. And when we first got on, once we were seated, after a little while we were traveling, they started singing, and I'm just talking about the black artists really. Who were on the tour. They, you know, because there were white artists as well. There was the Shangri-Las. Who else called?
Tommy Rowe.
Tommy Rowe.
Yeah.
Tommy Rowe.
Yes. Del Shannon.
Del Shannon, yes. Big artist, big white artist. But they didn't ask them to sing. And then they turned to us and they said, okay, you sing something. And we thought, oh my God, they're going to hate us. You know, they've just made these glorious sounds, you know. And I said to Cole, listen, let's sing a Beatles song. Let's sing If I Fell. And we sang the whole of If I Fell in harmony. And they all absolutely applauded at the end, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, actually.
After that, they completely accepted us and it was great. And then when we get to gigs, what was the black doo-wop group that was with us, Cole?
The Larks.
The Larks. And other people as well. They would say to me, come and play piano for us and we'll start having a jam, you know. And all that was going on, wasn't it? It was absolutely great. But what Colin said about some of the things we didn't really understand, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, on the days we were travelling through the night, we would go into a restaurant and have something to eat. And there was one particular night when Colin and I walked either in or towards walking out in a restaurant with our arms each round one of the velvets. Colin had his arm round Caroline, I think, and I had my arm around one of the other velvets. And they had a huge hit with Needle in the Haystack and everything. And the whole restaurant went silent, absolutely silent. And then a white-faced tour manager ran up to us and said, you've got to stop that now. He said, you're going to get a shot. And we laughed. And we thought he was just being silly. But he was 100% serious. And we couldn't believe it.
I didn't laugh that much, actually.
We can laugh now.
We can laugh now. Yeah.
It's scary, and if they didn't prepare you for that in advance, that must have just been a shocking experience.
I remembered some more names. There were the Iketts were on there.
Yeah, yeah.
The Ad-Libs, who that had that great song.
D.D. Warwick. D.D. Warwick.
D.D. Warwick, yeah. There were sort of like 12 or 14 acts on the bus.
And they, most of them were being ripped off, weren't they, in the way that we were. Certainly the black acts were. Very sad.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's part of our legacy here. Yeah. You guys covered quite a few R&B songs, and, you know, with your voices, I had heard that they really had a lot of respect for you versus some of the other acts, so they wanted to sing with you guys. That's cool.
Yeah, really. And on the Murray the K Show, our very first the event that we worked on in the States, in the Brooklyn Fox, we were playing with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, and Patti used to come by every night and give us experiences and talk about the way she grew up in the black churches and waxing lyrical about it and singing bits and it was just great. And I remember her saying, "You've got to check out this new kid on the block, Aretha Franklin. Her name is." And then she told us about Nina Simone, whom we'd never heard of, and introduced us to so much. And we were still only 19 years old then, you know, and they really did. Yeah, they seemed to take us to their hearts, actually. And we were so knocked out with that. It was great.
Oh, do you have a favorite song of yours? This is for both of you.
Well, I would always say she's not there really, because it changed our lives. You know, we were when we recorded She's Not There, we were 18-year-old country boys with no great hopes of traveling around the world with hit records and things like that. We just loved the adventure of making music. And that song changed everything. Within a few weeks, we'd gone from playing locally around the town we came from, and we were appearing on a top concert tour around the UK with Dionne Warwick, The Searchers, the Isley Brothers, these great artists. And there were just a few weeks between playing little local clubs where we lived. So She's Not There changed everything. So I'll always have a great affection for that track. Rod?
Oh my God. That's so hard for me. Do you know, I like some of the things that we've done recently as much as anything. I honestly do. But at the same time, I tell you what, I'm going to choose something from Odyssey and Oracle, and it's a Chris White song, which was our first single release in America from Odyssey and Oracle. And it gave me shivers when I first heard it. And it was a great song, I think. It was never a hit in a million years. I mean, it never would be, and I don't know why they released it. But it's a song called Butcher's Tale. And it's about war, really. And again, you know, this is to do with the zeitgeist of the time. This is, you know, what was happening in Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera. And it was about the First World War. And actually, Chris called it a Butcher's Tale, Western Front 1916, because that was the particular campaign he was talking about. But in their wisdom, the record company called it 1914 because they thought he got the date of the start of the war wrong. Because we were on tour in the UK, by the time the album was ready to be released, we were brought up to approve it, and it was too late to change it. And you know, that's such a shame, really. And you know, people should have talked to us first about it. But in the time, CBS in the UK were the people that released the album, and I'm so pleased that they gave us the money to do it. It wasn't very much money, but they gave us the money to do it. But at the same time, because we weren't big artists at that time in the UK, particularly, they just made all the decisions themselves, and they didn't take our input into approval, etc. Very importantly, you know. So, but that's another example, really. But that's the one I'll choose off the top of my head. I'll choose that.
Well, I know you know this now, but I can't tell you. You were a very big artist in the U.S. None of us knew you weren't successful in England until the reunions. I was in a garage band in the 80s. We played Tell Her No. All your stuff came on the oldies radio station. There was a double record back then that had Odyssey and Oracle on one record and then all the early hits. So it was just Time of the Season or something like that. We just assumed you were like as big as the Kinks or the Hollies and those sort of bands.
Well, we were in some parts of the world, but because it was such a bigger place, the world in those days, we were based all the time in the UK. And we just didn't realize. Much later, we found out we usually had a hit somewhere in the world at any particular time. And we were completely amazed when we found this out. I mean, nowadays, you know, I'm fond of saying that if you have a hit in Outer Mongolia, you'll know within 2 hours, you know, because of social media and everything. In those days, we didn't even know that Time of the Season was climbing up the American charts until it had been out for several months, because it started very slowly. And then eventually we got a call from our American publisher who said, this has been climbing slowly for a long time. And he said, I think it's going to get to number one. And in Cashbox it did. In Billboard it was number two or three or something. So we just didn't know those things. But it had the result of the two writers in the band, Chris White and myself, we always had a very good income, and we didn't quite understand why that was, but it was because we had a very conscientious publisher who would pay us what our royalties really were. And that was quite unusual at the time as well. But we had a manager who, from the point of view of our live gigs and all our touring, we never did anything but break even. Even when we were touring with number one hits in America at the beginning, when we had She's Not There, we only broke even on those tours. So the other guys in the band just didn't make any money because they didn't have the publishing and writing income. And that's one of the main reasons why we broke up. I remember one particular day when Paul Atkinson, the guitarist, said, look, guys, I'm getting married and I've got no money. I'm gonna have to leave. And at that moment, we thought, you know, we've got to, Chris and I thought, we have to get our own ideas. I've already said this. We've got to get our own ideas of how our songs should sound. We didn't know if we could achieve that, but we did achieve it. And we all loved the album when it was finished. It just didn't get played anywhere at the time. But then about 10 years later, Chris White phoned me up. He had his kids at university. And he said, you know, Rod, Odyssey and Oracle is becoming a real cult classic amongst young kids at university. And I said, oh, yeah. And I put the phone down and I said to my wife, no, it's not. But it was. And it gradually grew and grew. And as you said earlier, that year in, year out now, it really sells in, you know, continually in really good quantities. And it never did when it first came out. It's extraordinary.
I think the marketing departments of record companies, they think, oh, this is a record that baby boomers would want. And sure, you have that audience that was there in the 60s, but it's yeah. something that works for a lot of different age groups. It means different things to them.
And that's so lovely, the fact that we feel we can still relate mm-hmm. to with our early stuff, right. you know, to people that, you know, we have young bands all the time come up to us and want to talk to us and talk to us about it. And we also have, you know, we might meet someone who's 18 years old who comes back afterwards and said, oh, my God, I just heard that song for the first time and it's blown me away. And we thought, well, I can't believe it, you know, all these years later. But for some reason, the tracks seem to still relate to people of a younger generation as well as people of different generations. And that was really unlooked for. And it's such a lovely feeling.
It might partially be because, you know, the lyrics aren't blatantly about things from the 60s. Like you were saying, what Time of the Season isn't about, you know, Vietnam, specifically the Summer of Love, and Butcher's Tale isn't about Vietnam, but it is about war. And those are things people can relate to, no matter what generation they are.
I think that's a very good point.
And the way
I always write songs is I'll have a trigger. I'll have an idea about something, but then I'll let that spin into wherever my mind goes, really. And I think if you can make it work, then people bring their own experiences to the lyrics, and they invest the song with their own experience as well, and whatever it means to them. I remember Colin saying to me about the conversation you had, Cole, with Bernie Taupin, and he wrote a song for you, and you said, what's this song about? And Bernie Taupin said, it's about whatever it means to you. And the thing was, it would have started from a point in Bernie's mind, but it then, if it works, it becomes something which can trigger all sorts of resonances in different people, and it can become important to them for different reasons. And you know, if a song really works, if you're lucky enough to make it work to that degree, then that's what will happen. And, you know, so I think that comes out of what you were just saying as well.
I just want to know a little bit more about the record. What's the general sound?
It's written basically, I think it's 8 of the songs so far. And Colin's written one of them, and there's just one more to. I think we're going to try and write. We really want to finish the album before this year, so we can tour next year with a new album. I mean, that's very important to us if we can possibly do that. And it's a combination I mean, we're very excited about it because we actually completed three of the tracks before lockdown really got bedded in. And we felt we were on a real roll. And in fact, we, just as a test, because I've got my own studio here and we only moved here a few years ago. So I wanted to check that everything was turning out to all our satisfaction, you know, with the recording process. So we actually sent it to a mastering engineer in the States that we really, really like. In fact, the first two tracks, just to take the thing completely, you know, from start to finish. And he was just blown away with it. And we had some terrific response. So that made us very excited. But then we had to stop. But at the same time, I would say, I mean, it was in my head that I really wanted the album to have some grooves, some really, really, when I say grooves, in the sense that She's Not There and Time of the Season were grooves, and in different ways, I really wanted to have those characteristics with some of the songs. But as a complete contrast, I wanted one song just to be voice, piano, and strings, which is why we initially got the strings involved. And that's turned out absolutely beautifully. And so it is a contrast, but in the way I think that some of the early Zombie stuff was a contrast as well. But, you know, with a different piece. I mean, you know, in the early material, there was the difference between, say, Time of the Season and, say, The Way I Feel Inside, for instance. You know, they're very different ways of approaching songs. And I wanted to get some of that difference, you know, I can't think of the word. But also Colin's song is one that I heard him do when he was playing guitar himself, actually. And it sounded, it was just voice and guitar, sounded absolutely beautiful. And I, you know, I said to Colin, oh, we've got to have that on the album as well, in some way or another, make it very intimate. You know, it may be when we start doing it, we'll add other things to it. It depends on how Colin feels about it and, you know, where we think it's going. But it's those sort of contrasts, really. But it was very important to me that some of the songs should be exciting as well. And also, we were very keen on almost going back in terms of technique, and recording stuff with the whole band playing at once in the way that we used to have to do in the mid-60s. There was no other way of doing it then. But you get that lovely interrelation, you know, with everyone listening to everybody else and slightly modifying how they're playing and singing to what they're hearing. And that doesn't mean we won't overdub. I mean, obviously, we'll put harmonies on and probably Colin will try some extra vocals to see if he can get it better from what we do live, etc. But it's so far, we're very excited about how it's turning out. I can't wait for it to be finished. Add to that, Cole.
Well, I was just going to say, just very, very roughly, we're probably about halfway through it. But
at the moment,
yes. You know, we've started recording about 7 or 8 tracks, but there's all sorts of overdubs and mixing that has to be done. So it's difficult to say how long it'll take, but in very, very rough terms, we're about halfway through.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
A lot of the bands I know that do that kind of stuff, they look for studios that don't have, you know, all the, you know, they look for old studios that you can only do like a 4-track or something because they want that sound.
I think you can use both techniques. Uh-huh. I mean, I've done a lot of record production. Uh-huh. And I've had some success with that as well over the years, you know, over many, many years now. I mean, we're both very old, so we've got a lot of experience under our belts.
Yeah, we're 10 days apart, actually, in age. So Rod's older than me.
Yes, you bastard. Yeah. Always younger than me, yeah. But at the same time, it's just that idea of going back, but also using modern techniques as well. I think you can really do that. I remember Paul McCartney once with the Beatles saying, towards the latter part of their career, saying, listen, we used to record so quickly. We've got to go back to that. And they tried just to do things exactly as they did when they started. He said, you know, as we did when we started, you know, we used to do a track and finish it in 3 hours. You know, what's happened? But after about a week, they said, okay, forget this. You know, because the thing is, I don't think there's any reason to completely turn the clock back, but you can use some of the best things about the way one used to record. And sometimes having limits, you're absolutely right, Vicky. If you've got boundaries and limits, that can really actually help things. It can really spark something that has more focus. So, you know, you have to try and use that as well. And in the end, I believe with all recording, it's all about performance in the end. If you haven't got performance, you've got nothing. And it's all about capturing performance and not just getting something that's pristine and, you know, with every track sounding absolutely perfect. You've got to capture something magical, I think. And that's what we always attempt to do. You know, it's easy to say and hard to do, but I think that's always the goal for what you're doing.
I want to remind people that the URL for tickets is, people can go both to the Zombies site and the Veep site, correct?
The Zombies is the Zombies music. If you just put Zombies music in one word, that will come up.
Okay, zombiesmusic.com, right? And that'll take you to the Veep site to order tickets for the September 18th live stream from Abbey Road. And the other, the Veep site is thezombies.veeps.com.